This is the Perfectly Mentored Podcast with your host, Jason Portnoy.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Perfectly Mentored. I'm your host, Jason Portnoy. My guest today, Devin Wills, a man that I met, a couple of years ago, and just from our first interaction, super impressed with him, built this relationship with him. You're going to be in for a treat. What a talented, super good guy. He's the president of A&W Contracting. He's executive director of Hands Across America, owner and CEO of Black Clover Holdings, owner and CEO of Empathy Lending. All this while being over 500 days sober. Congrats for that, brother. From drugs and alcohol, and just at the young age of
23.
Crazy. If you're like thinking that, you know, you've accomplished a lot, we're going back talking to a 23-year-old right now, and I just read just part of his amazing story. Devin, welcome, my man.
Thank you so much, man. It's awesome to see you.
Always great to connect with you, especially, and now on the podcast, so everyone can connect with you and meet with you. That's great. I'm happy for this.
Thanks for having me.
Let's give the listeners a little bit of insight into who you are and a little bit of your backstory. I mean, 23 years old, already such an impressive resume with so much more to go. I'm confident in that. Let's start from the beginning a little bit.
So I guess we could start back to before the tragedies that sent me down a bad path. I was about, let's say, 20 years old, regular kid. I went to college. I was wrestling on a scholarship at Life University. We were a pretty good team. We were always coming up third or fourth in the nation for wrestling. And so that was a big deal, especially in the South. Wrestling's really big up in North, but to be a real good contender in the college aspect was a real big thing in Georgia. So I loved wrestling. I ended up just kind of getting in trouble. I was always a troublemaker in school. Even just, you know, getting kicked out of school back when I was in middle school and just a class clown, never doing anything crazy, just really messing with people and just trying to be the funny guy and center of attention, trying to be an entertainer, I guess. And it just, it kept going from there, you know, and I, over my life, I tried to grow up a little bit here. I'd still get into trouble. And I eventually did get kicked out of college because I just didn't do what I was supposed to do. I was never really good at school. I just didn't like class. I ADHD type, just, you know, I see a squirrel and look right, see a bird, look left. And, you know, once I got kicked off the wrestling team, I just didn't have the passion to continue with college. I didn't really care that much wrestling. I was just an athlete guy and I just wanted to be there for college. So I started working with my dad at 20 in the roofing business that he started in 1992, A&W Contracting. And, I was earning 31 grand a year. That was a ton of money for a 20-year-old. I mean, I'm working with my dad, who's my best friend. And, you know, life, it wasn't so bad. He's teaching me the business. I'm on the roofs in the heat of the Georgia summer where it's humid as heck. And we're installing and I'm learning. We're having a great time.
Can I just interrupt for one quick second? Buddy. How do you react to you, leaving school or getting thrown out of college?
So I never told my dad that I got kicked off the wrestling team. And to this day, he never found out. What it was is I never missed wrestling practice. What really happened was I missed a exercise, like a morning lift. I had a stomach ache, wasn't feeling good. And it's a very strict school. So I didn't show up. I didn't text the coach. And I just was like, hey, I'm going to sleep in. It was like 4:30 in the morning when our lifts were. So I just slept in. I show up and I got in trouble, and I was already in trouble for not going to my academic requirements. You have an academic counselor you see once a week. I didn't go to that. So that's two strikes. They put me on probation. And then I ended up getting in trouble one more time. Three strikes, you're out, kicked me off the team. It broke my heart. I was really devastated because for me at 20, wrestling was everything. It got me a really good scholarship as a freshman to a good college. And I felt, you know, I felt like a loser. And when I started working with my dad, I never told him. I just kind of flunked out of school because I didn't go to class anymore. I actually started, I've been training jiu-jitsu and MMA since I was 13 years old. And so I started to train for MMA, and I eventually was getting ready for a fight, and I tore my ACL. And that was my excuse for my dad. I said, Dad, I can't wrestle because I tore my ACL 2 months after I got kicked off the team, but I'm trying to fight. And So I healed. He took care of me, moved back in with him, started roofing, started learning the business, was really happy with that. And then September 4th happened on 2017 on Labor Day, where my dad had an unexpected heart attack. And, it was really, really tough just because that was, my dad was my everything. My mom has not been in my life at this point for 6 years, you know, doing drugs and just being not a good mom, horrible toxic relationship growing up. You know, we had a broken family growing up. It was really just me and my dad, her side of the family. My mom just never clicked, not a lot of happy memories there. Very toxic and alcoholic, drug addicted mom, and just wasn't ever a good relationship. So when my dad had the heart attack, I ran upstairs. I checked his pulse. I had taken CPR before. And so I immediately sprung into action. I start doing a CPR into him and doing the compressions and breathing in his mouth. And I'm doing that for 10 minutes. Ambulance doesn't show up. You know, I'm trying to stay stoic and calm. And I'm like, you know, dad's going to make it. He's going to be fine. They finally show up. They take him. We go to the hospital. I'm with his fiance, and we're thinking, you know, we're gonna laugh about this. Dad just had a heart attack. You know, things would be fine. And then we get to the emergency room, and they say, "Hey, I hate to break it to you, but I think your father's gonna die on the table today." And it's just a gut punch, and I just couldn't. I still remember just being so broken to hearing that, and then. They let us watch them operate at my dad. They had like 10 people in there, tubes all in my dad. He's cut open. They're doing everything they can. And I really do appreciate them letting us watch them work on him. So we know it's a rough scene to see that, even to just do the CPR on him, but to be there to see that they're doing everything in their power to keep him alive was awesome. It really was. And unfortunately, you know, they called the time at 10:34. And I was devastated. I just lost the most important man in my life. And that's kind of when my life took a turn.
And how old were you when this happened?
I was 20 years old at this time. It was a month before my 21st birthday. And it was just a terrible, terrible time. And it just sent me down a really, really bad path from that point forward.
How were you able to stay so composed while going through that at such a young age? And, you know, obviously it was such a close relationship.
I think in the moment, it was just the adrenaline that rushed through me and had me hyper-focused. I took a CPR class. So I forgot why I took that.
So did I. And I don't think I could do anything.
Well, and this is the problem where transitioning into this, where I did the CPR and I'm, you know, you're supposed to break the breastplate and you're doing 30 compressions and two shallow breaths in the mouth. Like I understood that, but I don't talk about this with a lot of people, but what haunted me the most was he was laying on the bed early in the morning. I did the CPR on the bed with the mattress. So everything was good except for the fact that when you're pressing onto a body on the mattress, there's some spring there. So for many years, after the fact, I blamed myself internally for not actually putting him on the floor so that you have a way to press the breastbone and pump the heart. And I felt very, very, very bad for many, many years. I blamed myself. I said, hey, if I would have did this or if I would have did that, maybe my dad would still be alive. And, you know, at the moment I was composed, but I also feel like I could have done a lot better for a very long time. I was not at peace with myself.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all this because I think it's going to be really helpful for the listeners. You know, when your dad passed away, you've been very vocal, and people who know you, you've been very honest to say you went down a dark path right after that happened. I think listeners would assume that's expected, right? For any young man to go down a dark path after mm-hmm. a loss like that. But what was different about this path for you and just like, why was it so dark?
So for me, about at 16, I know everybody around that age, guys, you'd be around the groups, the parties, the high school stuff. So you start drinking a little bit and you start having a little fun. And it's just what you do when you're a kid. You go hang out with your friends and, you know, you drink a little bit. And so I started drinking at 16 years old. It was actually a Long Island sweet tea mixer. It was not real alcohol. It was disgusting. So I never drank it again. But I, you know, I started drinking, and, you know, throughout the years I would drink and party, and I got in with the wrong crowds. And for me, even at a young age, I enjoyed hanging out with older people who were just a lot more experienced, had careers and this and that. They just, I don't know if I felt a natural attraction to them just because they were older, more experienced, mature people, and less of the BS and the drama, which I love. And that also came with a lot of issues of going out. These people were making six figures, so they didn't work all the time. They did their stuff, but they partied hard. So I hung out with the party group, the guys who goes to clubs and the strip clubs and all sorts of things. And so that started way before my dad passed. And so for me at 20 years old, when I lose my dad, the only thing I could think of that would be my escapism to help me be happy and fill me with dopamine was partying, especially with drugs and alcohol. And I started going down the path of just going out every single night, drinking every day. And I have tons of videos of me just becoming the I'll do it guy, where in Atlanta, I was known as a guy who would chug an entire bottle of Tito's in the airport. And in Vegas, I'd go to clubs and bars. I'd spend every bit of money I had, even money that my dad had left me when he passed away, and spent it on drugs and alcohol, where it got so bad that my substance abuse was, I was using every single kind of drug every single day for many, many years. And it got horrible right after my dad died, because like I said, 20 years old, I don't know what makes me happy except for drugs, alcohol, girls, and partying with my friends.
So when you get into that kind of black hole, I would imagine, especially at your age, it's hard to find a way out and hard to see the light.
Yeah.
So now you being 500 days sober, over 500 days sober, which, I mean, again, congrats, super, super proud of you and super well deserved. What was the road to recovery like for you? Or, I mean, how'd you begin to start seeing your ways and at a young age being like, you know, I'm just having fun and partying versus like, no, something's really wrong here.
Yeah. So that's about what it was. It was, you know, and when I don't exaggerate, it was every single day I'm going out and I'm using drugs and alcohol. I'm waking up, taking shots of Jaeger. You know, I'm popping pills. I'm snorting things I shouldn't be doing. I'm, you know, the whippets, all sorts of crazy drugs just to get a high out of me, which you and me both know now are just short-term fixes for a long-term deep problem, a hole in my heart that I had gotten from losing my dad. And it got to the point where, you know, it's like Wednesday, I go out for any excuse to go out, I go out. Wing Wednesday, Thursday, college night, Fridays, regular party night, Saturday, and then Sundays, there's a football game or something. So it was a nonstop cycle. But after every 4 or 5 day binge of not going to sleep and just staying up and running from my problems, I would catch myself alone in my bed, hungover, recovering, feeling, man, this is there something else to life? Is, you know, just really thinking about things. And eventually, I loved board sports, skateboarding, snowboarding, windsurfing. It's like I like trying new things. So I had the opportunity to go to Montana and snowboard. And I said, I want you to go by myself. Like I saw a blog or something of somebody traveling by themselves and saying solo travel is one of the best things you can do for your mind. I was like, yeah, why not? That'd be cool. And I was going just for the snowboarding. But what I found was, I'm alone with my thoughts in the cabin on the mountain, and I'm thinking and I'm really digesting where I'm at in my life. I'm asking myself these questions that you don't ask when you're in a bar or in a club or surrounded by buddies, you know, just talking about sports and golf and whatever. And I start asking me these questions like, how'd you get here? What are you doing? What's your future look like? How are you going to sustain this? What if you die? Like, you know, there was a long time running joke in my group where I was using so much of different substances that people were joking like, dude, you're going to overdose in 5 years. And my rebuttal to that, because I'm a smart aleck, was, well, at least I'll go out with a smile. And I never thought of it as something like, it's terrible to hear. When I hear it now and I tell people, they're just like, dude, that's awful. And I was almost in a mental prison that I couldn't escape. The key was thrown away, locked away in a treasure chest of some sort. And I couldn't find a way out until I started digging inside my mind and figuring out that something's got to change. And that kind of planted the seed in my head that, Devin, you need to look for answers. And that's where I kind of found the desire to want to look at, you know, self-help and go to YouTube and start addressing these issues and these concerns I had.
I want to probe just a little bit further because, I mean, you're still young at this point. You're asking questions that most adults don't even ask themselves, right? When they're unhappy, yeah. Right? How do you have that type of self-awareness and that growth to realize you need to ask yourself these type of questions?
You know, I never, that's a great question. You know, I could never pinpoint where those thoughts came from. You know, my dad was, you know, he drank and he had fun, but of course he was successful and he could afford to do those things and had the time, the spare time to do it after 25 years in the roofing industry. And so for me, I think that the solitude was the most beneficial factor in this situation, where if I don't go on that trip and I start having these alone times to myself and second guessing, I don't have those thoughts. And for me, like, I wasn't a big reader at this time, and I wasn't big into classes and school and learning at the moment. I just think that for some reason there was something deep within me that was saying, you need to get help and you need to find a way out, because if you keep doing this and keep hanging around these people, you're going to go off the deep end and you're going to end up like somebody like Steve-O, who I'd seen go through recovery. And he might've been the subconscious thought in my head where that dude was on Jackass and doing crazy, disgusting things and had a really bad addiction, and he overcame. And I think things like that, stories like that, kind of deeply seated in my mind that, hey, maybe there's a way out of here.
So now you start asking yourself these type of questions. How do you begin the process to change your mindset? Was there a book that did it for you? Was there a bunch of different influencers that did it for you? How did the process start coming about of you changing that mindset?
So for me, this is what I'll tell you. I'm very curious. I have always been a super curious person. Even growing up, I asked a lot of questions. I was probing people. I'd probably get annoying at some point, just trying to just understand everything. I want to know everything. And I was always deeply curious about stuff. So, I'm asking myself these questions. I'm trying to figure out, like, what's the next step? What do I do? I'm so lost. And I feel like I'm locked in a prison and I'm trying to escape. So I'm looking for answers. And I go on YouTube and I start searching things. I'm starting to think about, what do I want to do with my life? Like, I'd never asked myself these questions, and I'm just trying to figure out, what is it that I can start doing? And I start thinking of things that interest me. And I don't know, I'm on YouTube and I'm scrolling, and next thing you know, I see this Grant Cardone guy, and I see him talking about the millionaire math or something like that. And I watched a 33 minute long video, and I probably watched it 4 or 5 times that night. And I'm just like, huh, this is interesting. It makes sense. And it's like a breakthrough. I just didn't think about business that way. I thought, because I've always been like an athlete, and I like the challenge, and I'm curious, and I'm looking at this like, oh, this is interesting. He starts talking about real estate. I was like, well, I've always liked buildings and skyscrapers. Like, even when I was a kid, I used to build Legos. I was crazy about Legos. So I'd build entire cities, skyscrapers as tall as you could build them, and nice bridges. So I've always been interested in architecture and buildings. So I'm like, well, real estate, let's look into that. So I go down like a 3-day rabbit hole where, I'm going through YouTube, and I'm obsessed, and I'm going crazy, and it's like a spark, and I've got a fire in me, and I'm like, maybe I should try to do something in real estate. And I end up buying his real estate book, How to Create Wealth in Real Estate Investing. And it eventually, I read the whole thing in one day, and I'd never read something that fast. And I'm just like, got that fire in me. Next thing you know, I buy a ticket to GrowthCon, and I'm already having these thoughts in my head, like, I need to change, I need answers. And I go to this event, and it totally changed my whole life.
What was it about it that changed your life?
I think it was just seeing, of course, the atmosphere has a lot to do with that. You've got the fire, the bright lights, the dude skydiving into the stadium.
Yeah.
But you're surrounded around, for me, a bunch of like business types, sharpshooters, clean cut people. And for me, that's what I lacked. I was with a bunch of people who were dwelling in basements and clubs and strip clubs, it was a totally night. It was a total shift for me. So I started aspiring to be more like that, because I was clinging on to the idea that I need something different. And for me, different was a total 180 position. So I went from doing drugs and stuff in clubs and basements and being depressed and suicidal to, I want to get clean cut and good at business, whatever that means. And then I start hearing Jesse Itzler speak and Grant Cardone speak. And within 10 minutes of Grant speaking about losing his dad and becoming sober on drugs, that was all I needed to hear. And that night, I call my girlfriend after the conference and I say, babe, I don't know what's going on. Because this is my first, I don't even know what a conference was at this point. So I'm like, this is crazy. I used to go to sporting events. And I'm like, I think I'm going to try to be sober for 60 days, stop everything, no drinking, no drugs, no soda, just cleanse myself. And she was so totally supportive. And I tell you this, I couldn't do anything without my girlfriend. She has been everything to me and backed me up through thick and thin, even especially through the withdrawals. And what turned in, what was from 60 days turned into a 1,000-day challenge, which is I'm halfway now. And honestly, I may never go back.
Incredible. I just want to ask you, for the listeners listening who may feel they're stuck or in a tight situation or they're lost, what advice do you have for them in order to figure their way out? I mean, you found your way. What advice would you have for them?
For them, I would say you need to surround yourself with really good people or take a vow of solitude for 2 weeks. Because what I did, the thing that really was what withheld my sobriety was all the friends that I hung out with that triggered me. And it was really me that was buying all these, the alcohol, the drugs, paying for the tabs, inviting everybody to go out to these places and just do whatever. I needed to remove myself from that environment. And that is the best advice I can give anybody. And it's so cliche and obvious, but I'm telling you the power it had on my entire life. Today, I can watch people take shots and go party, and I can see them on Instagram, you know, with their bottles in the club and doing whatever they're trying to show off for. I can see that and it doesn't even bother me anymore. It doesn't do anything to me because I put in the work for 6 months to go and hide solitude, tell all my friends, even the ones I've had for 10 years, friends I've known since first grade. I said, guys, I'm going on a journey of self-discovery. I need to just escape from everything. I need to just go to work, stay at home, work out, exercise, and get my mind right, because if I don't, I think I'm going to kill myself.
Were they supportive?
A lot of them were not. And I do not have those friendships anymore. A lot of them would call me names and joke at me and say, oh, come on, dude, you're being a baby. You'll be fine. Just have moderation. Oh, you can, oh, it'll be fine. Just a few shots and you can go home at 2. And we all know that's not what happens. They egg you on. And sometimes they don't realize they're doing that and they don't know you. They don't, a lot of time, I was the guy with the smile on my face for years after my dad. I cried here and there, but I tried to be the leader and the positive guy and was always the entertainer and the host. So a lot of them did not know the inner battle and the struggles I had internally, where I was just depressed and suicidal and I was very, very broken. It was up to me to take responsibility for my life and remove myself from any environments that triggered me for my life. It saved my life just removing myself. And so that's the best advice, is just if you focus on the environment, that's everything to on your road to recovery.
And I guess you got to be a little bit of have some self-awareness, right? There are a lot of people who
100%.
You know, I always look at people and I wonder, you know, beneath their smile, are they really that happy? Right? Are people really that happy? And most people aren't. And you never know someone's full story, but I feel like there are a lot of people that feel the need to put this out there, but aren't self-aware enough to figure out that, hey, putting on a smile is a band-aid. I need to address the real issue going on.
100%. And that's what it is. And that was where I came to terms with myself, was that I'm consuming them going and partying and I'm doing all these things and I'm around these people that aren't so good for my health. It's just a temporary fix, a temporary boost of dopamine, the laughs, the memories, they're all great and whatnot, but they're not addressing the real issue that you have. And whatever that is for you, for me, it was losing my father and not having my mom in my life and not really having a strong family unit. And for others, it may be something else, but you just got to have that self-awareness, like you just said, which is key, and then start focusing on designing an environment for success so that you can overcome any struggles in your life.
So let's talk about stepping into your father's role as president of the roofing company. You're still young now, but you're younger then, right? How did you take a leadership role and were, you know, the people who were there long before you got there understanding and respectful and be like, or were they like, who's this punk kid that's going to tell us what to do? What does he know?
Yeah, so it's an interesting... because when it started, my dad had built this company in 1992 all the way to 2017, where he put blood, sweat, and tears in this organization, and he built an incredible staff. And I think I attribute the greatest accomplishment my dad ever had was his ability to hire and fire the best people and get rid of the not so good ones, the ones that just weren't perfect for his organization, where they went on to be successful in their own right. And another thing that he really did well was he would have somebody in sales that wasn't excelling and shift them to another position, and they would do so well and better for themselves, their family, and the organization. So my dad has members and employees who have been there for 15 and 20 years. So of course, you know, a 20-year-old coming into this role and now being the successor to my father as the new president of the company, well, I don't know how I'd feel or how I'd take that. I mean, that's a lot of uncertainty there, especially given my background of being a partier and a troublemaker when I was younger. And so you don't know what to expect. And, you know, I'd been around the business my whole life doing OSHA safety inspections. I've been in the warehouse doing service repair work, installing shingles for roofs and homes with my dad. So I had some experience, but not the type of experience needed to run the company and go acquire new businesses and new accounts. So in the beginning, it was a lot of uncertainty, but you know, over the year, the couple of years where I was going down a bad hole, it got a lot of really more uncertain for them. But eventually when I got my life together and I pledged to be sober and just to go down a journey of self-mastery and improvement, I started winning them over, their trust, and building great relationships with them to where now they trust me and they know that I've got their backs every step of the way.
But I mean, when someone's livelihood's dependent here, right? Like they're sitting there saying, okay, I got to feed family. Here's this young kid coming in. Forget whether you've been around the business, but what did you even know about business or running a business at that point? Did you pull someone aside, a senior leader, like an advisor that was there for your dad and be like, hey, I need you to guide me. You give me the opportunity. I'm going to learn and grow and help all this, but I need your help.
So you know exactly what I did. So I struggled with a little bit of an ego issue, and everybody has their own versions of ego. And for me, it was the know-it-all, I have to be right, this and that. So eventually when I started tackling that, and I started looking at myself inwardly and addressing every weakness and flaw that I had, one of them was my ego. So when I got to working on that, and I started asking myself, what do I need to do to improve and become better in all aspects of my life? One of them was to ask for help and not bottle my emotions up. That's what got me into the jam with my drug addiction. And so once I started asking people for help, I got really good at it. Like I'm at the point in my life where I will ask anybody for their perspective because everybody has something new to teach you. And so I asked the VP, the GM, the salesman, the service department, even the warehouse guys, how they did things. What did they do? How can I improve? How can I understand your position and what you're doing better? Kind of shadow people a little bit. I've even asked my dad's longtime CPA of 25 years. I'll call him and ask him questions. And of course, I'll pay for his time, but that information is very, very valuable. I don't know anything about taxes or balance sheets or P&Ls at this time. I don't know how to manage people. I don't know who works well with who. And I don't know anything of these aspects of business, even the marketing aspect. I don't know any of this. So I stepped outside of myself and I started having courage and asking for help, and it's what I received. And eventually I started becoming very much liked by everybody who was involved in the business and outside of the business because I was just willing to listen and to understand more and improve.
Which is funny because what would your advice be for the young listeners listening who think that, you know, no one's going to take me seriously. I'm 20, I'm 22. No one's ever going to take me seriously. What's your thoughts on that?
That's what I thought. That is my exact thought. I was like, I'm 20 years old. I got peach fuzz on my face. I have no experience. I don't have any brand equity. Nobody knows who I am. It's just, it's like you have to stop having those, what Tom Bilyeu says is automatic negative thoughts. Get rid of the ants in your mind. And if you start addressing that negative self-talk, then you start working on the positive, more optimistic outlook where if you're really putting in the time and you're asking questions and you're very serious and you're not joking around and playing around and half-assed doing things, you can get really far with people and you can win people over. There was a book, I think it's right behind me, where it's I can't even remember what it was called, but it's a book about being a leader that's not in charge. How to lead when you're not in charge. And one of the things you do is you can build build respect and authority within the organization with more lower and middle tier individuals of that organization. And you do that by helping them, offering just to do little things like, can I go pick up your roofing samples or go pick up a check? Or can I help you do this or help you read plans? You know, you just give until you build up experience and the knowledge to where now people know you know what you're talking about because you put in the sweat equity early on. So that's my advice, is just, it is going to be a grind. It's going to be a hustle, but it's all about building relationships early on and just being liked.
With your past and the party ways, does coming into a successful business and getting and inheriting that money, that type of money and that type of freedom that you could possibly have, does it scare you at all?
It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying because, like I said, I was roofing with my dad, and roofing is no hard job. I think it's the fourth hardest job in America right now. And even on my first day, I fell off the roof. And I had a harness on. I had my safety protection gear on. It's a one-story roof, but I had too much slack in the rope. I slipped because it was drizzling a little bit. I slipped, I fell. And you think in the movies you can pull your hammer out and smack the roof and you like an ice pick and you'd save your life. No, I fell. It was, there's nothing you could do. It's seconds. I fell on my shoulder. I messed it up. And, you know, I'm earning $31,000 a year, which I can't complain because my dad is the president. He pays for everything. I'm like 20 years old. He's paid for me to go to college, paid for all my food and vacations, everything. So I owe it to this man, but
it's $30,000 with an expense account.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. I got a charge account pretty much with my dad, but I'm happy to do it because I'm with my dad, and it was some of the most precious times I had with him. But, for me, I actually forgot what your question was.
It was coming into all that money. Was that scary?
Oh, so I'm going from 30,000 roofing to, you know, making a lot more money than I ever had, plus some money that he'd left me to take care of me and my sister. It was very scary because I don't know how to manage money. And, you know, I had people tell me, you know, if I had, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $1 million, I could manage it good. I could do this with that. I would do that with that. I wouldn't spend it all. And you look at some of these famous athletes like Mike Tyson, $300 million he went through. Evander Holyfield, like a lot of these famous athletes, they go from being 18-year-olds in college to now being multimillionaires. If you are bad with money and you come into money like lottery winners, 90% of them go broke, you're not going to be good with money just because you have it. And that was my situation. I had some money. I had a better income. I had stability, but I don't know what to do with money. I don't know how to manage it, how to budget it, how to invest it. So it was terrifying. And that's what kind of got me looking into like real estate and investing and savings and all these other different financial assets that I could hide my money so I have a better equated to use it.
After all this, I mean, so now you're in that role. You now assume the role of executive director of a charity. I know you and I know how important charity is to you. But why is it so important? Let's tell the listeners. I mean, such a young age, you could do so many other things with your money. You could go to sporting game. You could go. Well, now you can't. But like you could go do whatever you want. But it usually comes. What I've seen is it usually comes later. That notion of giving back and that giver's gain. That whole mindset. At 23, you rarely see that. Why is it so important to you?
I think it's really in my DNA to give. I've even. Throughout my past in first grade, I remember now I took my dad had these, I think they're $1 bills here, the gold little $1 bills, and he had 40 of them. I took them one day because I wanted to take all my friends out for ice cream. And so ice creams were 25 cents in first grade. And so ever since that day, like I bought the whole class ice cream, and I still don't know why the teacher didn't think it's weird that I don't even know how old I was, 7-year-old has $40 and $1 coins and he's buying the class ice cream. But I'd always had that giving mentality. Growing up, I'd always give more. I'd give the shirt off my back. I'd go pick you up out of jail. I'd drive 2 hours to go to your game if we were really good friends. Like it's just kind of who I've always been. And so it's always been important to me. I built some incredible relationships from giving and never expecting anything in return. It's similar to my position as the executive director. I take no salary. Nobody makes money in this charity. It's just it's important to just give and give and give, because I really truly believe one of the best relationships you can ever build with somebody is one where you're not asking for anything in return. And it really develops into something beautiful, I believe. And that's why it's important. If you're, you know, a lot of older people, when they have the money to give, they do it. But I really think that if you start building that habit early, even if you only have $100 to give a month, you're building a great habit, and it's going to make you more kind, and you're going to seek more opportunities to give and build that muscle. And it's just, it makes the world a better place, in my position, or in my opinion, when you're giving it even at the lower tiers of your life cycle, and then compared to just waiting till later on when you can.
But I mean, like, it's so weird. I don't mean to keep knocking your age, but I just find it so incredible, like at this age to view the world that way. I want to also add to this that you went even further and you added more to your plate and you started a real estate company, and a lending company. Let's add that to it. Most people are stuck in their 9-to-5s. Most people are complaining there's only 24 hours in a day. They don't have the time. Yet you keep adding to your plate. Why?
So what I'll tell you is this is what I tell my friends who still drink and party. And I don't knock that at all. I think it's okay to have an escapism. Everything is fine in moderation. Too much of anything is bad for you. I actually have a habit of overindulging in things. It's kind of, I have like an obsessive, addictive personality. But if you channel that for good things that are productive and positive, it can be phenomenal for not just for yourself, but for your community, for the world. And so for me, I look at it as like when I was drinking, I'm going out 4 to 5 times a week. But if you look at it in this way, the time I save from not going out to bars and not drinking and just going to house parties and hanging out, or even just recovering from the party, is, let's say you're going out on Saturday and Sunday only, not even counting Friday. That's 52 weekends times 2 days per week. That's 104 days a year. That's a lot of time. That's a third of your year. So if you're spending those days, and not even counting Friday, it's a little bit more with Friday, drinking, partying, and not doing anything productive, compared to somebody who's 365 around the clock, building their brand, building their business, growing and improving the community, you're going to be 33% more productive than anybody. So I fill that time with things that are productive and that are good for the community that also fulfill me. And that's what charity's always done for me. That's what the real estate's done for me. The Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and the MMA that I train with the lending company, networking, building connections, just it all, it's just all productive and fulfilling to me because I love it. It's a game, it's fun, and it's just, it's really, really empowering for me, and it helps me stay straight and narrow.
Going back to your circle of friends and your close circle, right? Like, a lot of people never understand your age and your close friends, what mm-hmm. you're going through, right? What you're building, because most people who are 40 don't have the ambition you have at 23, right? So they either don't get it, or they're trying to drag you back, or, you know, hey, my friend now just is the baller around here. He's got the money. How do I just try to stay friends with him and do it that way? How do you vet your circle now? Are you very protective of who you let into that circle now? And how do you build that trust? Because you are a loyal person, right? So by being a giver, you tend to open up a little bit more and get taken advantage of a lot more.
So that's a great question. And I actually I see the good in people. I've always been a super optimist, and I try to see the good in everybody. I think everybody's got a story. There's two sides to every story, and you don't, you know, someone may be wronging you in some way, but you don't know, you don't understand. And for me personally, I've always believed that even when I'm investing with people or I'm doing business with you, if you screw me over and you do wrong to me, I blame myself. I take full responsibility for that because I made the decision. I transferred the money. I paid you. I decided to spend time in the meetings with you and the conferences and to vet you. It's my responsibility why things went bad. And so in that aspect, it's my responsibility. But with the friends group and the vetting, it's become one of those things where I had a lot of friends that I was hanging out with that I've known since first grade. And I still see a lot of them to this day. But because of how busy I've gotten, there's some trade-offs and some sacrifices. And the 4 hours you'd spend at lunch with somebody or doing this or that, you don't have the time for that because you're building something great. And I always tell my friends in my circles, like, don't take it personally that I'm not spending time with you right now. I'm trying to build a life to where I can create opportunities for you in the future, because I feel like if I can build a great organization, whether it be through the roofing company that's already established but still growing very strongly, or the lending companies or the real estate companies or the charities, if I can grow those things really big with the team we have, there's room for more people, and that's more families we feed, that's more people having an impact, and that's just more productivity overall. And if I can do that, that's the sacrifice I'm willing to make in my 20s and 30s so that in my 40s, those friends that stood by my side and always supported me have a place at the table where they can not only make money and support their families, but have a very fulfilling future.
Love it. So what are you up to now, as if everything we just talked about isn't enough and isn't a full plate? What are your plans now, and what do you have lined up for the future?
Well,
what do you envision?
Really, I mean, one of my biggest goals is just to help a million people. And like, I feel very strongly, I feel very strongly about my humanitarian work and helping the world improve. And, you know, with racial and socioeconomic injustices being very much a problem and still prevalent, you know, with the charity especially, we're really dialing in and working on helping the next generation of kids. So even though I'm 23, it wasn't so far along that I had my struggles in high school and middle school and elementary school. So one of the things we're really trying to push, and that's why I did the charity, just to fill the empty space of my calendar, if there is any, is just to help the children get access to opportunity and resources they need. This could be backpacks or laptops even, or suitcases or whatever they need that'll help them. Right now we're doing a campaign to acquire 1,000 jackets for in the winter time. So we're trying to, you can buy them now in clearance because it's summer, for $10 to $20 on Amazon. And we've already raised 200 jackets, and we're going to distribute these to group homes and children's shelters and foster care units so that these kids can at least stay warm in the winter. And just, that's just a way I think we can help them with a tangible but really impactful goal. So that's one of the things I'm working on, and just really trying to grow the real estate business so that I can have more passive income so I can focus on the charity more and have more people in place with the roofing companies and the other other organization I'm a part of to manage those so we can really have big impact in our community.
Evan, I look at other 23-year-olds and I sit there and say I have zero in common with them, just at my age, right? And man, like, they're so, like, the immaturity level on them is just, look, as expected, they're 23. They should be immature. They should be having fun, right? I'm not knocking it. You get it all out in your 20s, right? Like, I wish I was back to 23.
Yeah.
But something that I say all the time is, I wish I was 23 with the knowledge and experience I have now.
Yeah.
And you're there, right? So really, thank you so much for coming on here and sharing your story. I know it's hard for you to talk about at times, but I think it's super helpful. And I think it gives a lot of context into the man that you are today, the talented business owner, the operator, the charitable person that you are, the kind giving person that you are. I'm just honored to have met you and fortunate to have met you and call you. And I'm lucky to call you a friend, and really appreciate you taking your time out of your busy day. I know, because we just went through your entire resume, how busy you actually are. But really, thank you for coming on.
I really appreciate you, and it's always good to connect with you. You're one of the good ones, and I'm very proud to see the growth you've had on your personal journey, and it's very inspiring, honestly.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for paying attention and tuning into that episode. If you enjoyed it, please do me a favor. Go leave a 5-star review, leave a review, leave some comments, share it with some friends, spread the love. It would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for your attention and for tuning in, and I will see you on the next episode.